Is that right?
You're good.
So not only on, but mute. I had that last week. This week is a little bit more difficult for me to see mute and hit it. I remember one time when I was a commandant officer training school, I only made about 1,001 speeches. And every time, you know, my execs would take it, just set everything up. I would just show up. They would clip everything on me, and I would just stand there, and they'd do their thing. I'd walk out there and do my part. And it was the last speech I was ever going to make in front of this big audience. And I thought, well, this is it. This is the last one. I'm going to go out with a big hoorah, you know. And I walked down there, and it was just like that. Nobody could hear me. And I didn't have my glasses on. They kept yelling at me, turn the mic on. I looked down at this little fuzzy black thing, and it had just a bunch of little buttons and little lights and stuff. And I was like, standing in front of everybody, I was like, somebody's going to have to help me. So that was the start of a really great speech, I thought. But no, it was, okay, anyway, so here we are. The overview of John, this is important. I think you'll get a lot out of this just because as we look at John and the overview of John, even if we never got to the textual study of it, it will help us to understand who John is, why he's writing these things, why his gospel is so peculiar and unique to the gospels and the writing of the New Testament. It has been very enlightening to me and eye-opening, and I am striving to share that with you as well. We have covered many things, and I believe this is about where we left off right here. There are 7 signs that are said to be attributed to John, 7 important signs, but you can notice that I have an asterisk there by number 8, because it is one that is unique to John's gospel, and that is that he had a multitude of catch of fish. And you say, wait a minute, that happened in one of the other gospels. Well, wait a minute, that happened in the beginning of his ministry in another gospel. And this is very unique because it happens at the end after his resurrection, and it is also, I believe, tied in with why the disciple whom Jesus loved said, it is the Lord. Because that's how their ministry had started. That was when Peter had fell down on his feet and said, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man. And he was so impressed with this multitude and catch of fishes. And then at the very end, when Jesus is making his final appearances to them, they seem what scattered without the shepherd. They don't know what they're doing. Peter says, I go a fishing. Well, we're going to go with you. We don't have anything else to do. And then, of course, this is that particular miracle, the miraculous, where John looks up at a shore, a figure that I suppose he doesn't really recognize, but he recognizes the work and the signs. Just like Jesus had told the Pharisees, if you don't believe in me, believe in the works that I do. If I don't do the works of my Father, then don't believe in me. But if I do the works of my Father, believe in the works. And that's where the apostles were in the end. 7 signs, water to wine. This is an interesting one. When we get into the text, we'll cover this a little bit more. It is very interesting to us why John covers certain of these miracles, and what he calls signs and works, rather than the Gospels. If you look at Luke, he's got a pile of them. He's got a whole list of them. And John's going through with the most important message. In other words, he's centering and focusing on the deity of Jesus. That's what he wants, right? These things are written that you may believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God, the living God. Believing you may have life in his name. That's the purpose of his gospel. So why would he cut out the multitude of the miracles and only give us 7? Isn't that interesting? But with the 7 he gives us, as we ask ourselves that question as we're going along, is it just because most of these were not covered in the other gospels? And John comes along later in life around 90 AD and says, you know, they missed a couple. No, we're told we missed a lot. But why these 7? Why these 7? And then when John records these things, what about John chapter 2? Is it that fabulous to you that he turned water to wine? Or did he indict the Pharisaical system by putting them into the firkins, the pots that were used for purification? You see, those pots were supposed to be used for nothing else, Mark chapter 7. The oral traditions of the elders and the Pharisees were now overemphasizing and were at a higher plane than the Word of God itself. And Jesus begins his ministry by absolutely shattering this age-old belief about these things and how important the purification process was under Judaism. And so it's those pots that he had filled with wine something that would desecrate them and denigrate them, and it would cause a stir if it hadn't have been for the guests at the feast that were more concerned that they had this wine now. Interesting why he includes the certain signs that he does. Chapter 4, of course, healing of the nobleman's son, as we said last week, at a distance. Not even there, not even laying on of the hands, nothing like that, but healing at a distance. Healing of the lame man in chapter 5. In chapter 6, we find the multitude, the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on water. Those are the two signs that are repeated in the other Gospels. But we find out something else about the feeding of the 5,000 that we won't find in the other Gospels. When we go through the textual study, we'll find out exactly what happens there. Just like the Sermon on the Mount and everything that Jesus said, he is trying to transition their mind from fleshly Israel and the physical things of this life to a spiritual kingdom with certain people, even in this world, in this day and age, they don't seem to be able to get. And he takes that very teaching and they narrate it in such a fashion that you find out when they come back around the sea and they say, hey, here we are, we're following you in the multitudes. He says, you're doing it because your bellies were full. And then they bring up Moses, that he had fed him out of the manna of heaven. And he corrects them. Moses didn't feed you with the manna from heaven, the bread of heaven, but God fed you. And now he gives you the true bread of life, the physical Israel, sustenance in the wilderness, God taking care of them. And he says, now he gives you the true bread out of life, the spiritual bread. Get your mind off your belly. He says the same thing in John chapter 4 when his apostles come to him. He says, I have meat that you know not of. Where did you get this meat? Where did he get this? Where's he been? Who's come here and fed him? My meat is to do my Father's work. Get your mind off the physical, and it happens again and again, which absolutely, I believe, fits in the context of what he says when he says to the woman at the well, worship in spirit and in truth. We'll talk about that later. The blind man in chapter 9 stirs up more conflict, more individuals determined to take him down, and the raising of Lazarus. Here's one that the critics will be all over. Seems to be such a fantastic narrative. Not only that it shocks their world that the Pharisees and people that could watch it, some would believe, that watched a man raised from the dead. Are you surprised? Or are you more shocked that some of them ran back to the Pharisees and the scribes and the elders and said, this is what he did. People are following him. He raised this man from the dead. Well, how can we take care of that? Well, we can kill him. How about Lazarus? Well, let's kill him too. And get rid of all the evidence. We can't have this. But the critics will come to us and say, well, what a fantastic situation. It's not covered in any of the other Gospels. Kind of makes you wonder what happened and how it would have been to be there, because we don't have nearly anything that he did in comparison to what's written. And John tells us that in the end. If he did so many other things, if we were to write them in these books, the world itself could not hold those books. There's only a purpose behind what we've told you. And then there were statements by others, by Nathanael, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God, the King of Israel. Two titles that he lays on him from the very beginning. And Jesus telling him, oh, Nathanael, you'll see greater things than these. And the blind man, if he asked if he believed in the Son of God, who is he that I might believe? You hath both seen him, and it is who is speaking to you. And then he worships him. Martha, she does believe in the resurrection. Yea, believe, I have believed that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, even he that cometh into the world. And Thomas, of course, my Lord and my God. And of course, we went over last week the seven great I am statements. You could add eight, right? In John chapter 8 with the great I am. Before Abraham was, I am. He does that purposefully. And of course, they pick up stones to stone him. There is no mistake about that. No matter who you are, C.S. Lewis was right. He cannot be a good man. He cannot be just another great prophet. He is either the Lord God himself in flesh, or he's the biggest charlatan and fake that the world has ever seen. To be a good man is the only option Jesus, through the Gospel of John, does not allow. The resurrection, of course, is the greatest of all. Romans 1 and 4. Matthew 12 and 39. An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, but there'll be no sign given it. Which is an odd statement to say in the midst of the miraculous age of the first century. But there'll be no sign given it, except for Jonah and the prophet. As he was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. John talks about his manhood as well. He is wearied with a journey in John chapter 4. The question has to be asked, why were they even there, Chris? Why were they in Samaria? How many Jews are walking through Samaria going their way to Galilee? No, they would cross over the Jordan River. They would cross over the Jabbok River. They would go over into Perea because they're not going to walk through that desecrated people, the heathens, the Samaritan who they hated, and the Samaritan hated them and had Pharisees killed. And when John Hyrcanus went up onto Mount Gerizim and demolished the temple that had been built there as a judgment on Samaria, the rift starting probably in Ezra and Nehemiah's day. You have no part in this. Well, we want to help. We don't need your help. You go your way and we'll go ours. And from that point on, there was never a joining together, even though living side by side in Palestine. They would normally go into Perea, but for some reason the apostles go through Samaria. And Jesus, being tired and weary, sits down. I'm going to try to bring up something else about John chapter 4 in my lesson from the pulpit today, if I can remember. If I don't, then remind me next week and we'll talk about it, because I think it's interesting about the dialogue there. We'll talk about dialogue too. He's troubled in John chapter 12 and 13 about being lifted up in front of the world and because of those who he entrusted that were going to betray him, Judas Iscariot. And then there's John chapter 11 and verse 32. Jesus sees the Jews in anguish and the sisters crying. The reason this speaks to passion so much is because this is someone that knows all. Here is a man, God himself, who's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. Right? He even says, you know, I'm glad this happened for the glory of God, to show them. He knows what's going to happen. And yet he still looks on this trauma and the mental anguish that the Jews crying, the sisters weeping, and gets carried away in the human moment and weeps himself. It's an amazing account of his feelings, his empathizing for mankind. When I talk about Samaria, the question came up the other day. In fact, I was talking to one of my daughters about it, the history of Samaria. If you want to read the history of Samaria, you start in 2 Kings chapter 17. That's the history of Samaria. And from that point, with the Assyrians that come in and take over, to export all of those people and bring in all of these other conquered people. And then I'll throw this out to you as Bible readers and Bible scholars. There's the plague of the lions. That's the one you have. That's the one that's not very popular. When's the last time we heard about the plague of the lions? You know, you throw out that to most classes and they say, well, wait a minute, there were 10. I don't remember the lions being one of them. No, there were the plague of the lions. And through God's providence, it's interesting. What's happened is, since Jeroboam's time, the northern kingdom has absolutely prostituted themselves and thrown off Jehovah God in all forms and fashions. And then he comes in, and in chapter 17, he tells you exactly why his patience has run out and why they will be carried away and annihilated as the northern tribes of Israel. The only one to be left, he says, is Judah. But he's going to annihilate the rest. He's going to carry them off. And then in the Assyrian fashion, they're going to bring in other captured people, foreign blood, into that land. And with them, what do they bring? They bring their idols. They bring the passing through the fire. They bring the sacrifices. They bring all the things with them. And even then, God can't take it. He can't stand it. And he sends the lions into the land, knowing that when they're plagued with lions, the leadership will look at it and go, the gods of this land are displeased. And so they send back into the captive areas where they sent the Israel off. They said, listen, we need to bring a priest back over here to teach us about the God of this area. And so he does. Isn't that amazing? that even in their captivity, that land itself keeps the name of Jehovah alive from that moment on by bringing the priests back in under God's protection and care. Kind of an amazing story, really. The outline and the structure of John are very different. You know where the others have started. We look at the prologue. We're going to call that chapter 1, 1 through 18. That's the prologue. It's going to highlight things, and it's going to kind of tantalize us and just give us some tidbits that they're going to develop later on. And it kind of starts with this just kind of a profound statements, and there's the light, and there's the glory, and there's these things that you can't hardly comprehend. And later in the book, it gets bigger and louder, and then it crescendos at the end into a quiet moment in the garden with one woman, Mary Magdalene. A woman that would be a witness not in that time for the rest of the world. And she would change the world through five words: I have seen the Lord. So we break the narrative up from chapter 1 into 21 into two parts: the self-revelation of Christ to the world, the self-revelation of Christ to the disciples. So we go to the self-revelation of Christ to the world. We start in verse 19 because the first 18 are the prologue, right? So we start in 19 and we go through about 1250, which is the end of chapter 12. But he makes a proclamation of who he is in the first four chapters. And there'd be no mistaking about it. He's making a proclamation to the world, and then in chapter 5 begins the great conflict. You can't come to turn the world upside down without great conflict. In fact, in chapter 5, of course, the lame man builds up this big controversy, and of course, he does it on the Sabbath day. And you have to ask yourself the question: is it incidental that Jesus is doing all these miracles and one happens to be on the Sabbath and they tell us about that one because it just happened to create the conflict? Or is it that Jesus is pointedly going and healing on the Sabbath, saying, it's time to stir it up, let's get this thing going? That's basically what he did in chapter 2, right, with the firkins and the purifications, water to wine. It couldn't be just simple. Go get the empty bags of wine that you just had. Go get the empty jars of wine. Fill those up. He could have easily done that. But no, he turns to the purification process and says, well, why don't you fill those? So he's doing that on the Sabbath. In chapter 6, the people come to me. He's very blunt, obviously. He talks there. In fact, he talks to them in such a fashion where they say, who can hear this? And many of them turn away from him. And, of course, his apostles, he asks them, are you going to leave as well? Where are we going to go? Where are we going to go? You have the words of life. Chapter 7, where does the conflict begin there? What a sad statement. His brothers, of course, James, Joseph, Judas, Simon, non-believers. In fact, more than non-believers. They're ridiculing him. They're mocking him in chapter 7. Because there's the feast and they're saying, go up to the feast. What prophet wants to be known but does these things in secret? If you do these things, let your disciples see him. Go up. Of course, they had a price on his head in Jerusalem. His brothers don't care. They're just going to send him up because he's out of his mind at this point as far as they're concerned. They're part of the crowd, and they're wanting to get him away as his friends in Mark chapter 3. Well, he's out of his mind, and later you find out his brothers, those same ones standing without, calling him out, thinking the same things. Chapter 7, they did not believe in him. And Jesus has to turn to him and say, the world cannot hate you, but me it hateth, because I testify of its works, and its works are evil. What conflict. And then the Jews themselves. Chapter 8, he brings it on. One of those statements that'll just reverberate down through history. Before Abraham was, I am. And as I talked before, certain cults, certain religious movements, certain people trying to downplay who Jesus is, where he came from, that somehow there was these relations in heaven with a goddess, and then he's been born and was the first begotten of a god to be brought into this world. And he's telling everyone they're wrong. And that John 1 and 14 is exactly what it meant. God became flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Chapter 9, the blind man. How much controversy can you create with giving someone their sight? The the blind man was cast out of the synagogue. He's disfellowshipped. He's cast out. He thought his position was bad before. Now he can see, and now he can see the hypocrisy and the evils of the world like he had never seen it before. Chapter 10, the Feast of the Dedication. We'll talk about that. He's walking on Solomon's porch. It's also the Feast of the Lights, where the candelabra was lit. That's when he comes out with the great statement, "I am the light of the world." But they can't stand it. If you are the Christ, come out. How long do you hold us in suspense? Tell us plainly. Of course, he tells them, "I and the Father are one." And that would earn him the attempted stoning. Lazarus, Caiaphas prophesied that one man must die for the people after he heard about Lazarus. He plotted to kill Lazarus. Unbelief of the people. Self-revelation to the disciples now. So after 12, we have conflict from 5 to 12 with his revelation to the world. Now is the self-revelation to the disciples. You see how different this narrative is when it starts off and it goes very, very quickly through his ministry. And then now we get to a point where he is going to have so much dialogue. You're going to have more words of Jesus than in any other place in the gospel record. And he's going to start and he's talking with these apostles and he's giving them these lessons. And like we said, if you had the red letter edition of the Bible, it's just going to be completely red throughout 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, the Lord's Prayer before he gets to the trial, and 18 where we'll cover things that are not covered in the other Gospels. He has the Last Supper. We're the only one in John. John's Gospel is the only one that points directly to the timing of this. Did it happen on the Sabbath? Did it happen on the Passover, or was it before the Passover? When they sat around and had the Lord's Supper, was it on the Passover meal, or were they eating it early? John's the one that points to the fact that when the lambs were killed on the Passover, Jesus was on the cross crying out at the same time. You don't get that in the other Gospels. As the lambs of Jerusalem were being led of the blood of their throat, he'd be hanging on the cross at the same time. John's the only Gospel that gives you that picture. One discourse to the disciples, 14, 15, and 16. We talked about that before. Remember when we were talking about the Holy Spirit and how convoluted everybody's ideas can get when we forget who's talking and to whom he's talking and why he's talking. He's talking to his apostles. He's telling them, "I'm going to leave, but I'm going to leave the Comforter. And these are the things the Comforter is going to do for you." Any man claims that today, then you believe in the succession of apostleship, just like the Roman Catholic Empire. And then in 18, you get to the betrayal and trial. And we're going to talk about the structure and style and why that's very different. 18, 19, and 20, victory through death. The epilogue is in 21. That would be the way that the book is broken down, at least, and we can make some kind of sense of it and follow the dialogue. The structure and style compared to the other gospel writers. Synoptic meaning, of course, seeing the same together. Optic, seeing, sin, together. Why is John not included? Well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke overlap many of the episodes, the things that they say, but yet John's perspective is so very different. Written for a different audience or a different time to point to a different theme. Those things that we need to mine out of the book. The structure and the style, the prologue starts where? As we discussed before, it doesn't start with the baptistry or the baptism of Jesus. It doesn't start with his birth. And it doesn't skip from his birth and then right into his ministry, but it starts before all of that. And it doesn't matter who you think or where you think the beginning is. It's before the beginning. It's a continuing existence with God. God himself, the prologue. So it starts in a very different place, and then it goes into the witness of John. And throughout the Gospel of John, the witness is going to be so very, very important. He begins before the world was, the eternality and deity of Jesus. Where does it take place? It takes place in Judea. Where do the other Gospels take place? Galilee. In fact, there's markers in the other Gospels. For instance, in Matthew 19, when he faces towards Jerusalem, the marker is, you know he's not in Jerusalem in Judea because he sets foot to go that direction for the last week. So you know he's not there. And this is the only Gospel that doesn't have that marker in it. Mark has the marker in it. Mark chapter 10, Luke chapter 17 has the same marker. We're heading now to Judea, to Jerusalem. Why? Because we haven't been there. We've been in Galilee. But that's not what happens in John. He's more concerned about what goes on in Judea, what goes on in Jerusalem. Very few places in chapter 2, chapter 4, part of it, that he is not in Judea. And so that would give us a different perspective. That's one reason things are covered here that are not covered in the other Gospels. And then the Passover feast. You know that John, you know, when you grow up and you just hear things, how long was Jesus' ministry? Well, it was three and a half years. How do you know that? Who told us that? Did Matthew tell you it was 3 years? Did Mark? No. Did Luke? No. You know how we know it was three and a half years? John, because he marks the years with the Passovers. Isn't that something? He marks the years with the Passovers, and it's the only gospel to mention all three Passovers. The one in the beginning, there's one in the middle, and then there's one towards the end when he sits down with his disciples and it's all over. So that's kind of an interesting part. The writer of John, as I said before, was not only a Jew, but he was a Jew from that area that was very familiar with what was going on in Judea at the time. If he writes in 90 AD, not everybody is any longer, right? 70 AD crushes that system, gets rid of the records, scatters the people. But now he's writing about these other things, and he writes about different feasts that nobody else can write about. There's the Passovers listed for you there. Let's talk about these other feasts. The Feast of the Tabernacles. We're familiar with this one, Feast of the Booths also. Okay, it's in the fall, September, October, kind of the final harvest of that time. But also what happens in the fall on the 10th day of that very month is a Day of Atonement. So the Day of Atonement takes place on the 10th, and then you go into the Feast of Booths, which is the 15th through the 21st. That's a week. And they're living in booths to commemorate what? Wanderings in the wilderness. And then a day of solemnity, or the solemn day, on the 8th day there, on the 22nd. The Feast of the Dedication is another feast that's talked about in John's gospel and no other gospel. Where are you going to look that up? Is that Leviticus 23, like the Feast of the Booths? Where does the Feast of the Dedication come from? It's not in your Old Testament. In fact, it's only mentioned here. It just comes out like a shot out of the blue from a Jewish writer in the first century. It's the Feast of the Dedication. He's very familiar with it, but we're not. Neither was the Old Testament Hebrew. Where did that come from, the Feast of the Dedication? Alexander dies in, what, 323 B.C., and Palestine is in chaos, as is the rest of the country. Daniel tells us there's going to be four big generals that take over the four ends of the earth. And that those four generals are really five in the beginning. We know it's five, but what happens to the fifth one? Well, four of them gang up on the fifth and get rid of him. That's the way I like to slide a pie too. Four of you gang up on one, get rid of him. Now you got four, you got four. And why are we always talking about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids? Why is it just two? I say, well, I thought Daniel said four. Well, you know what? Over in Europe is a different space we're not even concerned with. Asia Minor is a different territory. We're not even concerned with that. What we are talking about is Syria and some of Babylonia and then Egypt. And what's sandwiched in between those two, like a little brother sandwiched into a big fight there in the kitchen? It's Palestine. So you got the Seleucids up to the north in Syria. You got Ptolemies in Egypt. And which one of them control Palestine? Well, you're all Bible students. You ought to know this right off the top of your head. Which one controls Palestine? Before you answer, I just tell you, it's a trick question. It changes hands about eight, nine times. Eight or nine times between those generals and who's struggling. And so this is going on. And then, of course, you have the Antiochus Epiphanes that comes in. There's a demand that they sacrifice to Zeus. And of course, there's an old man up in Modin that refuses to sacrifice, and his name is what? Mattathias. He's got five sons, and they pretty much have to pull out and do something. And so they run up into the hill country, and they start a guerrilla warfare that's very, very effective. And his sons come in, and of course, there's Antiochus Epiphanes, who has now sacrificed a pig in the temple. He's refused circumcision. He's refused the people to do all these things. In fact, this is the way Mattathias starts off. He's the priest in Modin. the soldiers stand there, and the officer walks up to him and says, "You're going to sacrifice right now to the god Zeus." He says, "I'm not going to do it." And so one of the young Hebrews walks out of the village. He's like, "Oh my, give me this. I'll do it." What do you think Mattathias does? He runs that guy through right there. Just kills the kid. Bam! That's the way you think about it. Kills him, kills the officer, and then they're off into the hills. And then after that, the guerrilla warfare starts. It's the Maccabean Revolt. And then one of his sons, two of them actually, very, very successful, and a grandson as well. So when Epiphanes desecrates the temple, smears the pig's blood everywhere, and does all these things, just hammering out the sensibilities of the Hebrews, finally, you have Judas Maccabees, one of the sons of Mattathias at this time, who's gaining control. He comes in and cleanses the temple and rededicates it. And from that day on, from the intertestamental period, is the Feast of the Dedication. And it goes all the way to today, and today it's called what? Anybody know this one? It's Hanukkah. That's where Hanukkah comes from, the Feast of Lights. Feast of Lights. That's why we know when he's walking in Solomon's porch in the Feast of Lights and the Feast of Dedication that they have a big, huge candelabra that they're lighting out on the edge of the porch. And somewhere in there, we hear him say the statement, "I am the light of the world." Not just down this hillside, not on that side of the porch, but of the world. And so the contextual understanding here really brings it out and what he's using. So John's gospel is different, gives us some different things to think about and chew on. A Hebrew of Hebrews writing it. He's got lengthy discourses. This is the greatest place. This is one of those that it's a book that has been made into a movie, and the screenplay was already written by a man named John. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to make up any dialogue. You know, there's no movie about Jesus you've ever seen where they just don't make up all these scenes in this dialogue. There's been this scene that's shot. It's a movie that was shot with just the dialogue out of John. Because it's so easy to do, because it's written for you. It's just involved dialogue exactly of what Jesus is saying. For instance, in Nicodemus, instead of just the incident and some kind of parabolic teaching and then a moving on, there's just this long dialogue. You can't even, sometimes people argue whether or not, did Jesus say all those things, or did somewhere in there John picks up the narrative and explains more about what he knew? But for all we know, it's all in red. It's Jesus' sayings, what he's teaching and what he's taking the opportunity to teach. Feast of the Tabernacles. In chapter 7, detailed conversation and dialogue, same thing. He also has double meaning or play on words. It's really interesting. For instance, in John 1 and 5, "And the light shineth in the darkness, darkness apprehended it not." What does the apprehended mean? In fact, if you have the American Standard, it says apprehended. What's the King James say? Comprehended? Well, those are two different words. Which one is right? And the ESV has something. Okay, so you look it up and you say, "Well, we're going to look this up." Or you ask somebody like Giff, who doesn't have to look it up. And then they tell you, "Well, the word actually means both." Could be both. It could be comprehended, or it could be to obtain and get a hold of, control. You go, "Well, which one is it?" Well, that's the whole thing. It could be either one, and both of them fit. And John's gospel is replete with that. Isn't that amazing? You look the word up, you go, "What exactly is he saying?" You go, "Well, he could have said either one." And it fits. And so that's one thing that John does so well. And then repeats the theme in the negative. That's kind of an interesting one. You know, like John 3 and 16, right? "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world." You notice how he does that? This is why he sent his Son. This is what he's doing. "But then God sent not his Son into the world to judge the world," right? "But that the world should be saved through him." And he does that again and again, the contrast. It's like a juxtaposition of contrasting ideas. This is what it is. This is what it's not. What did he say about the good shepherd, or the shepherd of the sheep? And he starts off with the negative there, right? He says, "If any man does not come into the door, but climbs in some other way, what is he? He's a thief and he's a robber. But he who enters in the door is the shepherd of the sheep." And that's what he does again and again. John 12, right? "He that believeth in me believeth not in me, but him that sent me." He that receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. You know, he goes, not. This is what it is. This is what it's not. It's a very contrasting style. He does that at 1 John as well, 1 John chapter 1, and we'll see some of the other things that he does it. I told you before, you can tell with that evidence, the same individual has the same style and writes these books because the questionability of who actually wrote it. You know, he didn't put his signature on it, say, hey, I'm John, I wrote it. But it's pretty easy to see that the same style is there. And then, of course, the person of Christ, the deity, more than any other book. You can't not help but to read John. And that story I told you about the Arab that was searching for truth and he begins to read these things, you cannot help but to come up with the questions of who Jesus was and what do I need to do about it in my life. I'm going to go to the second part of these, the trial of Jesus. Annas, the high priest. Well, I thought it was Caiaphas. Well, you know, Mark does tell you it was in or Luke says in 3:2, he says, in the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. But John's the only gospel we find out where there's a huge part of this trial that's missing from the other gospels. That's kind of interesting. Huge part of the trial is missing. The piece that's missing in the other gospels is in front of Annas, who he goes to first. And he's technically, he's the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Why is he calling him the high priest? Well, because he was the high priest until he was ousted by the Roman powers that be. And they started selling the priesthood that had started back in the Maccabean era, in the intertestamental period. And once the Jews themselves started selling the priesthood, then all of the ruling powers were just more than happy to oblige. If I'm the governor of Judea, and my forerunners have been getting great sums of money from these slovenly people that are actually selling their souls for the priesthood, well, then I'm going to ask for a price too. And that's exactly what happens. One of them sells the priesthood and promises an exorbitant amount of money to the governor. And the governor goes, all right, I'll make you priest. You know how he paid it off? He went and robbed the temple. He took all the things out of the temple, went out and sold them, paid off the governor. Now he's high priest, so that power was more important to him. That's what the Jews were doing themselves. And so the Roman government is more than happy to oblige, and then they come in at the will. So now they don't recognize hereditary Levitical priesthood, right? Not at all. And so here is Annas. He does something to make somebody angry. Somebody else does something, and so they start switching priests. That's interesting in John's gospel. We can go into that even more and what Josephus says about those things because it was supposed to be an annual priesthood. The critics come to the Bible and say, the Bible doesn't know what they're talking about because it's an annual thing. Well, not necessarily. And it's because Annas was always thought of as the people's priest. He was the one that was recognized by the Pharisees and Sadducees as being the high priest. But they knew he had been officially dethroned. But you see who pulls the strings? Annas. He goes to Annas first, because why? Well, before we proceed, I want to know what Annas' take on this guy is. We're fixing to kill him. We want to know what Annas has got to say about it. When we find out Annas is good with it, we're all good to go. Now we'll take him to Caiaphas, and we'll run through the chute. When he's in front of Annas, here's another thing about John. And you don't get this unless you dig into it a little bit. What have you taught in the temple, Jesus? What have you been saying? Well, I've ever taught in the temple. I spoke openly. I spoke to the people. All kind of people heard me. Is that what he's saying? No, actually, there's something in the Greek language called the emphatic. And the emphatic position of the word there is I. So he looks at Annas, who's holding an illegal trial at night, who asks him about his teaching that he has done publicly for 3 years. And this is the way you read it. I have spoke openly. I have been in the temple in front of people. I have taught in front of the disciples. I have said things that the multitudes have heard. In other words, what are we doing here, Annas? What are we doing here in the little dark, in the recesses of the midnight hour with an illegal trial where you're secretly with your little officers around asking these questions as if you have some authority? You see how that changes the dialogue? We'll find that out with Pilate as well. When Pilate's asking Jesus, you know, he says, well, art thou a king then? He's not saying that at all. He's mocking Jesus. The emphatic is in the you. Are you a king? You've got to be kidding me. You're a mess. Look at you. Who are you? That's what Pilate is saying, just by looking at the emphatic of what is being said. Interesting, isn't it? That's John's hard-hitting style. The resurrection scene is very different. It gets very personal. I think it's probably just at least the best account out of the Gospels that we have. It's just absolutely amazing. Like I said before, and as I've talked before, for a gospel writer, a religious writer of the first century to pick out a woman to be the first and foremost witness of a resurrection is absolutely mind-blowing. Because her witness wouldn't have been allowed in any kind of court against a man. She wouldn't have been looked at as respected as a witness. Nobody would select her. Just like when they list his brothers, you know, well, there's James, there's Joseph, there's Judas, there's Simon, well, there's their sisters. That's very typical. But we find out that there was a woman, not even a high status woman, but a woman that had seven demons cast out. You can imagine the life she was living before, and she's the witness to the resurrection. She's the one that counts it all. Amazing. The structure and the style, the tragedy of rejection. We talked about that a little bit. He came into his own, and his own received him not. Chapter 4. There's his brothers. No man doeth these things in secret. Go up where they can hear you. If you do these things, if you do these works, and let your disciples see them, even his brothers. And then, of course, Caiaphas in chapter 11. This is the amazing power and providence of God. Caiaphas thinks he's sentencing to a man that is a bothersome to him, an insurrectionist. And he goes, well, you know, it's expedient that one man die, that all the people will not perish. And God is controlling the strings the whole time. He's controlling the events of history. Thank you, Caiaphas. You're so right. Because you're going to bring the right one to the cross. And he's going to absolutely save the world. Caiaphas has no idea what he's saying and how big that is to the history of the world. There's a phrase that John uses. I think this would be an interesting lesson of itself, maybe a couple. And that is for fear of the Jews. John, more than any other writer, begins to cite and call things, instead of the scribes or the Pharisees or the lawyers or the doctors of the law, instead of that, he's using this phrase, the Jews. Well, he's certainly not meaning all the Jews. But he is talking about the leadership of the Jews. But by 90 AD, is it significant that he's just kind of, he's saying it's the Jews? For fear of the Jews. This is what the Jews did. The Jews killed him. The Jews did this. The Jews did that. Well, he's talking about that leadership, that system that was in place, the hierarchy and the ranking and the status of the Jewish leadership, which we find again and again through Josephus' writings or someone else, that they absolutely were run roughshod over the people. And so John, more than anybody else, and he uses this phrase, for fear of the Jews, the Feast of the Tabernacle. Joseph of Arimathea, disciple, but secretly, for fear of the Jews. Disciples met in secret. What in the world has happened? Why are they meeting in secret? For fear of the Jews. Very interesting take. John is one of the Gospels, more than any other. He stresses, for instance, in 1935, he that hath seen this hath borne witness. And his witness is true. And he knoweth that he saith true, he uses a different word, we'll go into that later, that you also may believe. Two different words for true, but he also stresses an idea of doing the truth. Doing the truth. Not believing it, not knowing it, not writing it, not reading it, not meditating on it, but he says a phrase, he uses it, he that doeth truth. That's different in John's gospel. So we can slip now into lesson 3. I knew I was going to try to skim through that, and we'll get into more of the outline and the structure of the book. These are the 3 themes of John that I've picked out that seem to be fairly obvious. Probably all of you would think the same. We're going to talk about 3 things that he continues to contrast through his book. Truth and witness, always going hand in hand. amazing statements about witness. We'll find out why it's absolutely erroneous today to use the phrase in the way that the gospel writers use witness. You don't witness today. You can't witness. Not in the way John uses it. Not in the very least. That's denominational talk, but it's not from St. John or the Gospel of John. And then light and glory, always going hand in hand, building up, fire burning brighter and brighter through the gospel to crescendo in the end into the quiet scene in the garden and then judgment and life. The Gospel of John, it is doing great things for me. I appreciate your kind attention, and hopefully, Lord willing, we'll be able to go on with that. And if not finishing it up this quarter or this month, I've got some things on my plate maybe coming up, but then we'll certainly try to get back to it. But just very rewarding. Thanks so much.